Hi, I'm Matt Salinger, Captain America from the 1990 version, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome, fans of comic books, graphic novels, and the movies and TV shows that spring to life from those four-color adventures. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair where, once again, comic books come to life. Here at Comic Book Central, we celebrate those that are bringing our favorite fun books to life on the big screen, on the small screen, live action, animation, you name it. You don't have to go anywhere else. It is right here. Today on the show, we're going to pick up right where we left off last week. Hope you had a chance to check out my conversation with Max Hernandez, who portrayed S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Jasper Sitwell in this summer's Marvel blockbuster, Captain America: The Winter Soldier. But you know, while we're all enjoying the renaissance of Marvel movies, the foundation for this cinematic universe was put into place way back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and that's where my guest today comes in. In just a moment, you will hear from the star of the 1990 Captain America film, Matt Salinger. These days, Marvel movies rule the box office. For proof, look no further than the smashing success of Captain America: The Winter Soldier. But believe it or not, there was a time when bringing the Sentinel of Liberty to the big screen wasn't as simple as picking a premiere date for the latest superhero flick. Sure, Cap found an audience on the small screen with two successful TV movies, but was Steve Rogers, skinny soldier wannabe, ready for the big screen as a super soldier? Well, one man was given the red boots, winged cowl, and his marching orders to find out. Actor Matt Salinger was cast as Captain America for the feature film. Now, if you ever had to read The Catcher in the Rye in high school, then you know the name Salinger. Matt's father was famed author J.D. Salinger. Now, Matt himself turned his creative streak in a different direction: acting. He made his film debut in the 80s comedy classic Revenge of the Nerds.
Get those nerds!
And he has since appeared on the small screen in Law & Order, Picket Fences, and 24, and on the big screen, right alongside Gene Hackman and Richard Gere in Power, and the imaginative fantasy tale What Dreams May Come with the late Robin Williams. But for comic book fans, Matt holds a place in the Heroes Hall of Fame as being the first actor to bring the original Marvel character, World War II hero Steve Rogers, Captain America, to life in a feature film.
Where'd you get your guinea pig?
Happens to be the best damn candidate out of 600 volunteers.
A secret experiment gave one man the strength of 100.
The rest of the world, he's just codenamed Captain America.
And the power to save millions.
The Jerry's had an experimental rocket ready to fire at a target somewhere in the United States.
Only he could defeat a superhuman madman.
They got a fella called the Red Skull heading up their outfit. All we can hope to get in there is one good man.
But saving the world left him trapped in an icy grave until fate released him to finish a battle started decades ago.
Yeah, he's still alive. We don't know where he is or who he is.
Now, an evil genius is on the verge of global domination.
Captain America, you gotta help us.
And only Captain America can stop him. Ronnie Cox, Ned Beatty, Darren McGavin, Kim Gillingham, Scott Pollard as the Red Skull, and Matt Salinger as the Marvel Comics hero, Captain America.
Well, my guest today was throwing down with the Red Skull on the big screen long before the current Captain America flicks, which makes him one of the founding members of the Marvel movie universe. A big welcome to Matt Salinger. Matt, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you very much, Joe.
I appreciate you having you here today. Now, before we get to Captain America, I definitely want to talk to you about a feature film of yours from 1998. Obviously, this the past few weeks, we've been reading so much now about the passing of Robin Williams. You did a film called What Dreams May Come with Robin. For our benefit, for the listeners' benefit, would you just kind of give us a glimpse of what it was like to work with Robin and really what we've lost with his unfortunate passing?
Well, he was a you know, so much has been said. He was a very sweet, giving, lovely, sensitive guy. I had a small part in that movie. I'd already, you know, mostly stepped out of acting. And, you know, I do it for fun now, and I'm much more comfortable doing it as a hobby than as a as a career. But, you know, so I played a reverend or a priest who married him and then officiated at the funeral as well. So it was like a two-day part, three-day part, I don't remember, small part. Often, you know, when you have small roles, the leading actors or stars are don't pay you much attention, and he was couldn't have been nicer. Cuba Gooding was lovely as well. They were both terrific. A friend of mine who is at the New Yorker has known Robin for years, and Robin's family, and actually I think Robin's brother, and she was just devastated by all this. I couldn't say Robin was a friend, but he was a lovely person and easy to work with, and it's a tragic, great loss.
Yeah, there's so many stories that come out of this from individuals that have worked with him, and they all seem to revolve around the same thing, was that he just reached out to people on the set. He just, you know, interacted with them, and I can't imagine just what it was like to work with him, to see him on the set. And I guess it probably depends on the movie that he was in too, whether it was, you know, full-blown comedy, or in this case, I guess this was like one of the more bizarre kind of surreal movies that he worked on. Like, how would you describe it for listeners who haven't seen that film?
Yeah, it's certainly, I think surreal is a pretty good word for it. It's very painterly. The special effects and the production design are amazing. It was early on with green screen, I guess, so maybe they're not as sophisticated, but it's a metaphysical story about love and redemption and it's not time travel, but sort of breaking through.
Almost like
the
dimensional
time
kind of thing. Is it like a dimensional kind of thing?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those movies of his that I don't know if it often gets mentioned. I've seen it on some lists and things, and obviously the one that's near and dear to my heart is Popeye. I like the second this happened, it's just like, you know, you kind of go through, you know, that initial shock, and then you just start watching the clips, and I just want to watch movies, and I just want to see stuff that he was in, and I just watch Popeye over again, and so, you know, grab a Robin Williams movie and just watch it. And if you haven't seen What Dreams May Come, get that one. I mean, that's a very cool one too.
Apparently, because it involves themes of death and rebirth and living after death, it's been hugely popular since his death. People wanting to see him again and see him in a story that has some applicability to what happened. But yeah, he was lovely. I mean, Joe, you'd be surprised. Some people that you think are going to be just boatloads of fun and easy to work with, and funny people, lovely people, turn out to be real. Robin, it could not have been further from the case with Robin. He was everything you hoped he would be.
Yeah, that's such a loss, but what a legacy of film work he's left behind. So, you know, again, you know, just as a in memorial to him, just go rent and or watch or buy or whatever a Robin Williams flick. And that's a good one to start with, too. So, well, let's talk about some other things here. For our listeners who think that your last name sounds familiar, they probably have a good reason to think that. Your father was famed author J.D. Salinger, author of Catcher in the Rye, many, many other stories as well. Did you ever think about following in your father's footsteps and becoming an author?
No, not really. Never really did. I think even if I'd had the impulse, he had some pretty big shoes to fill. And
that's an understatement.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd have wanted to try that.
It's almost like, you know, Steven Spielberg's kids or something, like deciding to become a film director or something, I guess, you know, or, you know. It's, I mean, had you gotten any, like, background from him, or, like, what it takes to become a writer, or some of the things that made him successful, any of those conversations, or was it just like, hey, that's Dad and that's what he does?
It was more the latter. later on. You'll learn a lot when and as your parents want to tell you things about their lives. You know, I didn't know much about, you know, his war experience until near the very end. And that doesn't make him any different than anyone else of his generation, I don't think. But
it's always one of those interesting things when you talk to family members of like famous authors and things like that. It's like you always kind of wonder, like, do you read their books, or, you know, do you kind of go through those things or try to see if you can get insight into, you know, where you came from that way? I mean, had you kind of done that over the years?
I was lucky, actually. All the courses I had when I was in high school and college that would have taught his work.
They made generally. You read Catcher in the Rye when you were kids?
Well,
like, done that.
Every course, I probably was in four different English classes that normally taught that book.
Yeah.
But because I was in it, they didn't. And I always assumed it was out of a preponderance of sensitivity, and it was only like years later that somebody said to me, "Are you kidding? You know, no, they didn't want you showing them up and saying, you know, like that scene in Woody Allen movie where he pulls the guy out from the line at the movie theater and says, "No, that's not the case at all. You know nothing of my work."
Yeah, I think you'd have a little inside track on what the book was all about. Yeah, that would have been an unfair advantage, I think. You know, late last year, it was rumored that your father might have written a prequel to Catcher in the Rye. Can you confirm that, or do we know? What do we know about that? Or is that one of those things that's like decades from now, we'll uncover this from his will or something?
Well, Shane Salerno seems to know a lot more about anything having to do with my father and my father's writing than I do. So if he said that, I'd take it to the bank.
Okay.
Is my voice dripping with sarcasm? Hey, Joe, I thought this was a comic book.
It is, but we go deep. We dig deep here on Comic Book Central. That's what it's all about. We dig deep before we get to the comic book stuff. You know, one thing, well, you know what, speaking of Captain America, let's talk about comic books. You have a degree in art history. Where do comic books fit in with art history?
Oh, boy. You'd probably have a better answer for that.
I don't have a degree in art history, so I do a podcast.
My thesis was on happenings and environmental art, so that was all sort of involved, you know, humans and bringing the attempts to bring, it's in the 60s, the sort of action of the art came to the front of the canvas, and then it came off the canvas in some way for happenings in environmental art. So, I guess Lichtenstein and Andy Warhol, you know, they certainly played with the comic cell structure, but I'm not the guy to talk to that.
Joe Simon and Jack Kirby didn't fit into your thesis?
No. But no.
Unfortunately, I saw it. I thought, you know what, maybe I can get a little perspective on this. But and again, speaking of Captain America, we talked to Reb Brown. You, not only the Star-Spangled Avenger do you have in common, but you both worked with Gene Hackman.
Oh, I'll be damned. That's funny.
Yeah, he was in a movie with Hackman. We talked a little bit about that. What was your experience working with Gene Hackman on the movie Power?
Oh, he was great. I it was the second movie I did, and I played a Oberlin, a history professor who was running for the Senate, nobody thought he had any chance, and I got to be sort of, my soul was being argued over by Richard Gere on the one hand, who was the slick sort of tech savvy newcomer to political consulting, and Gene Hackman, who was the old school guy that seemed to have a little bit more soul. But it was a gas. I mean, now that the movie, I mean, it was Sidney Lumet, and Sidney Lumet, you know, would do like one brilliant movie and then a couple of, you know, so-so movies. And this, I think, was one of the so-so movies, but it was an important subject matter, a worthwhile subject matter. And, it was at a time when people didn't really know that political consultants existed unless you were in that world.
Right. So
it was a lot of fun.
Some Hollywood heavyweights in that. So how, as an actor, especially when you're talking about, you know, early in your career, as an actor, how do you strike that balance between watching them and taking tips from them? And
yeah.
I got to work with them. I got to hold the screen with them. How do you kind of strike that balance of like, oh, I want to learn too while I'm doing this?
Well, there's some directors that make it easy, and Sidney was one of those. He actually, you know, he came from the theater, and even the first TV show that he did, they would have hour-long dramas, and a lot of people got their start. I forget what they were called now, but he had a very theater-like approach, and we rehearsed for a couple of weeks down in a rehearsal studio in Manhattan, scene by scene, and he would have the whole cast there. He wouldn't just bring people in.
Oh, wow. Everybody.
Everybody.
Wow.
And we'd go from start to finish of the movie.
So you already had an ease with these. So you were already kind of like, before film even rolled, you were kind of at ease with what you were doing.
Exactly.
Oh,
yep.
Nice. Yeah, what a technique then.
Yeah, it was really well rehearsed and explored, and he was open to improvisation, and he had his editor with him during rehearsals, so they would confer about what Andrew Monchain, I think, was his editor. They'd converse about what would work and what wouldn't, and if somebody's idea was good and could work, then he'd take it and use it. The writer was also there, so very inclusive, kind of exciting, heady process that spoiled the hell out of me. I thought this is the way all movies work.
Of course it is. Everybody's always there, and the writer's there. I can just ask questions anytime I want.
People really care.
It's such a mixed bag, I would guess, from project to project. So, well, it's probably good now. I mean, because you do producing now yourself, so you probably take a lot of those lessons with you.
Yeah, well, I from my acting days, I think every possible mistake that could be made in a film, I'd seen be made. So I've at least avoided some of them as a producer.
All right. You twisted my arm enough. We'll talk about Captain America. All right. Captain America, 1990 feature film. You auditioned for the role and then you turned it down when you got it. Well, is that correct?
Well, I didn't officially say no, but I hesitated
a bit.
Well, I wanted to make sure it was not a mainstream studio. You know, it was Canon Films that I think was later Golden Globus. You know, I knew the script was terrific. I mean, it was a really beautiful script.
Yeah.
Had a lot of heart, had a lot of soul, had real characters, and yet the sort of childlike simplicity and awe factor that you wanted it to have. And I was just worried about, you know, whether they would have the wherewithal to make it the way it was written. And I'd just been signed by CAA, I think, the year before, and I said to the senior agent that actually was brought in to negotiate this deal for me, I said, "Do you really think they have what it takes?" He said, "Well, there are a couple ways we can make sure." And I let him do his thing, and one of the ways was, you know, sort of balking and saying, "Well, show me the money, not for my salary," although they did that too.
Right.
But they said, "Show me the money, you know, that you can make this film." And they played a little bit of a shell game. I mean, look, I was quoted as, you know, I was pretty bitter early on because, you know, we didn't finish certain scenes, and during filming, a lot of things, you know, Albert would say, "Well, we're going to get this in post-production." And we got back to the United States from Italy and Yugoslavia, what was then Yugoslavia. And there really was, you know, there was no post-production. We did one day of pickup shots in California.
Wow.
Instead of the week. And we never went to Alaska. There was a whole scene, you know, two scenes that were supposed to take place up in Alaska. And,
yeah, Captain America's frozen. He's got a bust out of the ice.
Yeah, and I mean, they did that in a on a soundstage.
I was gonna say yes, exactly.
Not quite the same.
It's not Alaska, no.
But it was, you know, I don't blame Albert for this at all. I mean, he had the Albert's a good guy, and I think he could have done a good movie if he'd had the support. But, you know, what the story I heard is that Menachem, who also just died recently, Menachem was banking on a recent movie, something that Raul Julia was in. I forgot what it was. It was a horror movie that he was sure was going to be a big hit.
Oh, hoping that would blow up and take the money and roll it into that. Yeah,
exactly. And it died at the box office. I mean, it totally died. So, yeah, I mean, I was bitter for a while because it was just, I loved Captain America as a kid. I mean, I read Richie Rich and Captain America were the only two comic books I read. And I loved the Captain America and the Falcon. I remember talking to Stan Lee when he came over to Dubrovnik at one point. I said, you know, I was always hoping you were going to do Captain America and the Falcon. I just loved the two of them together. And, you know, he was thinking about it. But so I wanted them. It wasn't selfishness. I was just kind of doing the acting thing as a lark, and it was fun, and why not? I was young, and it was a good time.
Well, we talked a little bit off mic, too, and you mentioned you haven't seen the latest one yet, but I think you're going to like it. The Falcon's in it.
I heard. The Falcon, and I was really psyched on it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's crazy, because, and you could tell you're a producer, because it's like you had all the instincts right off the bat. We need the money, guys. Show me the money. Yeah. We need the Falcon. We need a tight script. I mean, you had all that right there. It's just,
well,
yeah, I know.
You know,
it's amazing.
I mean, you know, fool me once, you know, shame, you know the expression.
Yeah,
I should have known. I was going to London for some early fittings for the costume, and they hadn't got my plane ticket yet. So I went by the office to pick up the plane ticket, and I asked about per diem when I was over at, you know, this over in Hollywood at the Canon offices. Used to be on San Vicente. And they said, per diem, go see so-and-so. So I go down to so-and-so's office, and, oh, yeah, here. I was just going to come see if I could get you. The guy hands me a paper bag filled with, like, tens and 20s. You know, I'd left time to cash a check to go over to the bank. And I get this, like, greasy paper bag that God knows they probably had revenue coming in from their sales and some, you know, Middle Eastern country or Macedonia or, you know, who knows where. And I've seen that. I mean, that used to be at the AFM. People would come with suitcases full of cash to pay for their territorial sales. It was kind of the Wild West in those days.
Yeah.
I just, I guess I felt victimized by it for a while. At this point, it's just a funny thing to have done and a cool thing to have done. And I'm way past, like when my kids were young, it was really cool for them until they got to be about 14 or 15, and then they could see through that it was, you know, not the greatest movie.
Everything's cool to a kid until they're 14 or 15.
Well, exactly.
Then everything's, I hate everything, you know? So come on. I mean, in all fairness, it's, even if it had been great, they'd be like, I hate it.
Well, but I think in all fairness to all the adolescent kids and 20-year-olds out there, I had a fan base of all those, you know, under the age of 13 for a little while. But now it's just cool to have done. I mean, how many people get to play a superhero? Right?
How many people get to play superhero? How many people get to play Captain America? And I still like it. Sorry.
Good.
I like the film. Look, I love comic book movies. And here's the thing. This is actually the first time that the true Marvel Comics character was brought into live action. We had the serial back in the 40s. That was a different character, and he was packing heat. So that wasn't the same Steve Rogers character. Reb Brown, I loved the 70s TV movies, but he wasn't playing the original Captain America. He's playing the son of the original Captain America. So this is the first time we get the true origin on screen for the first time. We've got World War II. We've got Nazis. We've got the Red Skull. You're strapped to a missile. The Red Skull's Italian. Okay, we'll figure that one out later. There's all the elements are there, and what's striking to me, and you can talk about this a little bit, your perceptions of the film and the story, how you think it plays out, but the opening sequence is very similar to X-Men, and even the latest X-Men movie, where the Red Skull is kind of created as a child when his parents are killed before him. So that plays into the new Marvel movies, and we get that origin that's really you throwing down with a Red Skull in the classic costume.
Well, I don't want to burst any bubbles, but when you really think about the vocabulary of you know, comic books and comic book movies, you're not talking about that sophisticated.
Except for some of Stan Lee's writings, because some of those words you have to look up.
Well, the words, sure, but I mean, yeah. look at Batman. You get to the origins there. You see the parents die. There's a limited repertory of devices and things that quickly display, you know, psychological, you know, depth, angst, motivation, and comic books don't, you know. I can't swear on this, can I?
No, we'll keep it family friendly.
Comic books don't mess around with getting too intricate and too complicated. They go for the bold strokes, and the bold strokes are what generally move people. The nuance and all that. I mean, yeah, there's room for it, and a lot of them have that as well. But it plays a smaller role.
Well, and it's a shocking first few minutes, and you understand why the Red Skull became the Red Skull. You almost sympathize with him.
Yeah.
Which is, that's the mark of a great script. When you can sympathize with the villain, you're like, oh, I get why he's doing this.
Yeah. Well, what attracted me to the, and by the way, I mean, I think Albert was as attracted to the character of the Red Skull as Captain America, and I think that was... that was right, and the way it should be. I mean, he really balanced the two. But what attracted me to the one of the things that I liked about the script, and that made me think that I might be the right guy for it, was they'd seen a lot of, you know, muscle bound, you know, meatheads already that had auditioned, and they'd seen sort of a who's who of would be stars, but they wanted somebody that could bring the young sort of half crippled Steve Rogers to life in a
polio, right? I mean, it's in this particular version is polio, and
I just loved that they wanted an actor who could do that. And I mean, I worked out solid for you know, 2 months, but I still wasn't going to be. I remember I think they had offered the part to Howie Long at one point. Who I got to know later. But, you know, they talked to a lot of people that were sort of how you imagine a superhero to be. And I wasn't necessarily that guy. I mean, I was always athletic, and I'm not a ugly guy, but I'm not sure I would have cast me as... as Captain America, and I was grateful for it.
What's interesting about it is that you feel the spandex. I mean, you do what you had to do. But in those days, you don't have the CGI. Like today, they take Chris Evans and they make him teeny, you know.
Right.
And Reb Brown, we talked to him, and it's like he had to play kind of like a sensitive painter. So to kind of give that perception of I'm not that powerful. And I think in your case, you kind of played it down a little bit, kind of did the Christopher Reeve, Clark Kent-ish thing, slouched a little bit. And did they put bigger clothes on you?
No, I had a muscle suit. I had this. Well, they did. They put bigger
like in
clothes
the early
on
things
me.
When you're kind of in the kitchen and kind of walking around. And like even when you're getting the super soldier serum, they put this giant like hospital gown on you.
Yeah,
hide you because you're ripped underneath because you got to be your Captain America. We don't have special effects yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They made them real big, but they also did for the costumes. You know, I not only had the latex, you know, outer thing, but I had this like foam something, you know, to make my muscles even bigger.
Okay. Did the George Reeves thing a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
I don't mind admitting it.
No, it looks good. It looks great. I mean, I think the costume, I mean, it's the classic look. It really is.
I still have it in a box in my attic.
I was going to ask you that. We were going to get to that because I always asked the guys that play superheroes and the females that play superheroines, like, did you keep the costume? You still got it.
I do, yes. But the last time I took it out, the latex was looking pretty pretty nasty.
You don't like wear it around the house or something and, you know, scare the kids or something?
No, I think I actually have worn the boots to a couple of like Halloween things.
That's classic. Looks great. And let's talk about that cast too. Boy, what a stellar cast. Scott Paulin, we talked about the Red Skull. Ronnie Cox plays the president. Ned Beatty is in this. Yep. Darren McGavin, Bill Mumy. You had a great cast in this. Talk about some of your castmates and just how that helped your performance as you're going through this.
Well, the coolest thing about it is nobody got rich on this movie. And Albert really depended on people that were big fans of Captain America wanting to do it. Bill Mumy had been a comic book collector from the time of Lost in Space. So, I mean, he has a huge comic book collection. And, you know, he was like chasing all over after, I got to do this, I got to do this. But everybody...
Oh, he's giving you notes, like Captain America would do this?
No, he actually didn't. He was really cool, but he was just a big fan.
No, but that's great to know that it's like he's kind of like monitoring the comic book aspect of it.
Absolutely. And first day of...
And for our listeners, that, I mean, he's Will Robinson from Lost in Space.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So now this is, he's kind of like, you know, he's older at this point, and that's great.
Yeah, and even the older guys, I mean, they say that, you know, to be an actor, you keep a little bit of the kid in you as you age. And I would say every... Whether it's McGavin or Beatty or Ronnie Cox, you know, there was a lot of kid in all of them. I mean, there was a scene where the Ronnie Cox, who played the president, and I were up on the ramparts, and we help each other out in some way, and we'd improv this thing where we give each other, you know, the thumbs up, and he was like such a big kid. I mean, he was perfect as the president. I don't know, he'd probably be more like Bush Jr. than Bush Sr. But,
but interesting take looking back on it.
We actually did a TV series together a few years after that and had some fun there too. They were great guys. It was a great cast. And Kim Gillingham was lovely, who played my girlfriend in the thing. It was a great bunch. And God, we shot in Rovinia and in Dubrovnik and all along in Croatia and a little bit in Serbia.
It's an international production, and it really, I mean, when you're watching it, it has that feel to it. I mean, even though you didn't get the shot in Alaska, I mean, there is an international flavor to it.
Well, there's a shot, and somewhere in my files, I have a shot of me and my stunt double, who is this... actually, there were two of them, but this one guy from England, and the two of us are we're holding each other's hands in full costume, sort of skipping down a field, and it was the field that they shot Steve McQueen in Escape.
Oh, The Great Escape with the motorcycle.
Yeah. Exactly. It was the same field, right on the Austrian border. We got to see some film history, and it was a lot of fun.
Captain America is hand in hand running through the field, right?
I don't think Stan would probably, Marvel probably wouldn't like that too much. But
no. Well, Stan was, you said Stan was on the set too, correct? I mean, did he, so you got to interact with him a little bit?
Yeah, it was great.
What did he think? I mean, this is his creation come to life, and it's actually probably, you know, like I said, the classic costume. What was he thinking at the time?
I can't say. You know, I expressed some of my concerns to him, thinking that he might be an ally, even after the production ended, when some of the other shooting that, you know, I'd been told would happen didn't. You know, I wrote to him thinking that he might help me, you know, cajole Menachem in some way. So I don't know. I mean, he was excited to see his characters. I think he was, it was new territory for him. And in retrospect, it's really kind of cool to have, He actually rode, I think, in this little car that we had, a Fiat 500 that was in one of the scenes. I gave him a ride for fun one day up in the hills of...
Dressed as Captain America?
Yeah.
Yes.
Above Dubrovnik. And he was great. But to think that, you know, what has become of Marvel and Marvel films, and, I mean, my God, they're a force to be reckoned with now. It's pretty cool.
Oh, it's amazing, too. And did you get a chance to meet Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, the creators of Captain America, at any point?
I didn't, no. No, when the first Captain America, I forgot, who directed the first Chris Evans Captain America one?
Joe Johnston.
Yeah, that's right, Joe Johnston. Right, and I had tried to get in touch with him because I thought it'd be really cool to play like a cameo, even just some guy on the street as, you know, good luck, you know, or something. You know,
give him a little salute.
Passing of the torch kind of thing. Yeah. And they were interested, but I forgot they were already pretty much finished filming by the time I heard about it and, you know, not being in the thick of things anymore. So I don't think that ever got passed along, but,
There are plenty of Captain America movies on the horizon, so yeah, there's plenty of room for cameos for all of you guys too. Favorite moments in filming that you had? You had some great scenes. You get to throw down with the Red Skull. You get to sling the shield. You get to wear the costume. What were some of the moments that you remember? You're like, whoa! Especially this is your favorite comic book character.
I think you know there were two. There was one sort of action moment where. We were running out of daylight, and these cars had shown up from Germany that were to be part of the chase scene, after or before the motorcycles. I don't even remember the order of it all, but we were running out of daylight. We only had these cars until the end of the day, and the stunt guys that had come down had really kind of torched them on the drive down from Germany. And we had to get this one shot, and it involved me throwing the shield at a motorcycle that was coming at me. They couldn't get the stunt guy to do it, and it just wasn't working. And I said, look, I'm really good at Frisbee. I've been working this thing for a while. Let me try it. And take one, bam, you know, I overhand it. I'm lying on the ground, and I overhand sling it, and it actually hits the front wheel of the motorcycle.
Yes.
They weren't even taking it from that angle, but it hit the front wheel. That was pretty cool.
So that's the shot they got in the movie then?
It definitely was, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, that had to be a blast. Were you just like, did you just kind of like walk away and like, yeah, I just did that?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was great. But, you know, I lost like 25 pounds filming, because it was 100 degrees and I was in latex and foam.
It's a heavy suit.
Yeah, it was heavy, and as you say, without special effects, they left it all to that.
Well, even the cowl, it's like it covers your ears too, right? Because those are like those aren't your ears.
No, they're certainly not.
They're like rubber ears.
Well, didn't people gripe about that? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of watch it. I mean, it's never jumped out at me that I was like, those are, you know, it never really jumped out at me. But I hear, you know, it's.
I don't know why they did that.
Why they put the rubber ears in?
Yeah.
Did you ever ask? Did you just like, guys, I got cool ears. Like, I could just cut a hole in these.
No, I didn't ask. I don't know.
Well, you mentioned that Cap is your favorite comic book character. What did you bring from the comic books into that role? Like, how did you see, like, what did you feel you had to bring to the role as Captain America?
Well, there was something about his sense of justice. That I like to think I have, and I can fight pretty hard when I think somebody's doing somebody a disservice or an injustice. I like that about him. I like that he sort of that he began as an underdog, you know, and just found himself through this, you know, program and in a position able to do what he did. And I like that he, you know, I used to describe him, and I don't know if this is in keeping with the Marvel, you know, book of wishes or not, but I used to describe him as sort of extra human as opposed to superhuman. You know, he can't fly. He can't see through buildings. You know, he was just sort of the most like the fastest athlete, and he could jump higher and run faster and harder. And I saw that more as an extension of his will and his desire to be what he was being given a chance to be. And I think that's really compelling stuff. I think it's compelling stuff for a kid that is looking for role models, you know, and it's fun for adults too. Hell.
It's fun for all of us. Exactly. Hey, you mentioned the Marvel movies. What do you think of Chris Evans as Captain America now?
He was great. You know, I only saw the one, but I thought he was really good. It was very funny, you know, watching him, because some of the scenes, as you said, were sort of set pieces. You know, when he's strapped in and getting the early doses, and I could swear that some of the machines their production designers came up with looked exactly like the ones that we had.
It's very similar. I'm telling you, yeah. People haven't seen the movie. It's released on DVD recently too, I believe.
Yeah,
when the last Captain America came out, so get it. I mean, there's a lot of similarities to the backstory, and like you said, even the set design.
I should give the there was a company, I'm trying to remember the name of it, that did a Blu-ray version of it.
Yep, Shout Factory, I believe.
Yeah, the Shout Factory. That's
yep.
It. Yep.
Yeah, no, that stuff's out there. And did you see Avengers? Because we got Captain America in there too. Did you see that one yet?
I didn't see that one. My kids got too old.
it's interesting too, because you say the Falcon, because that was what you wanted, because in the comic books, now the Falcon is going to be taking over for Captain America. He's going to be the new Captain America, and I kind of get a sense too.
I didn't even know that.
Well, I kind of get a sense too that I know Chris Evans' contract is up through three films, so we've got the next Captain America, and they introduced the Falcon in this latest one. So I'm kind of wondering if they're, like, when he's done with Captain America, if they're going to kind of bring the Falcon in on the big screen too. So I don't know. Is that what they're setting up?
If his head gets too big and his agents are asking for too much money, they say, hey, it's going to be the Falcon.
Always hedge the bet. So, hey, again, you might be able to get to be in a Captain America movie with the Falcon. That'd be kind of cool, too, just, you know, kind of like, you know, giving him a salute as well.
That would be awesome. And does he have the motorcycle still and everything?
Captain America in...
The Falcon. He rode a motorcycle, didn't he?
He doesn't have a motorcycle in the latest film, but he's got the wings, and well, I don't want to ruin it for you, but, you know, there's some different things, but it's like he needs to adjust the suit for the next movie. Let's just put it that way. he needs to make a few tweaks to the suit.
Got it.
For the next movie, but he's a work in progress, but it's very cool.
Well, Joe, the next one of these movies that comes, are you based in New York?
No, I'm actually in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, yeah, then we're not going to go see it together. But if you were in New York, I'd say I'd come in and go see it with you.
I will. Hey, look, to get to go see Captain America with Captain America, I'll fly to New York. I got no problem with that, my friend. Latest projects that you're working on. You actually, we were talking, you actually just got back from shooting where you shot Captain America, correct?
Well, no, but...
Or near it.
But not too far away. I just did a film in you know, most of the films I do these days are producing. I do enough each year, you know, to keep my, you know, Screen Actors Guild insurance, and which is great insurance, and to have fun occasionally. And this was a film that would accomplish both. It was a Juliette Binoche and Gabriel Byrne movie about the Robert Byrd, the fellow who supposedly was the first to get to the North Pole. Juliette Binoche plays his wife, and Byrd actually isn't even in it. It's about her following him, wanting to be there and support him when he discovered the North Pole, and she ends up being stranded on the ice with some Inuits for most of the winter, and I played the captain, American sea captain, that brought them to Ellesmere Island.
Okay, so you're in front of the camera again.
Oh, yeah. Yep,
nice.
Yeah.
And what's the name of this? What's the name of this film?
Nobody Wants the Night is the name of it, and it's directed by a terrific Spanish director named Isabel Coixet. And I've done a film for her last year that's going to premiere in Toronto, I think next week. She called me out of the blue and said, "Do you want to come to Bulgaria?" So yeah, it's. It's fun, and getting to do a scene with Juliette Binoche, I don't know too many men that could pass that up.
Wow, again, a great cast, too. And you also, is there another film, Learning to Drive?
Yeah, that was the first one I did for Isabel. And yeah, that comes out, that's the one that's going to be in Toronto.
When's that one coming out?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they have a distributor yet.
Okay.
But Patricia Clarkson and Ben Kingsley, Sir Ben Kingsley.
Okay. So how can we find out more about these projects? Website, anything, or these films on Facebook?
You know, I your guess is as good as mine. I hate to say that.
You are off the radar a little bit, aren't you?
Well, I'm working on other things, you know, and and yeah, my fingers aren't on the pulse of the film industry so much right now.
Yeah, I had to do a little digging to find you. That's you are off the radar. Which look, a lot of us would love to be that. I don't know how you pulled it off, but it's pretty amazing too. Well, for somebody who's like semi-retired from acting, you seem to be kind of busy in front of the camera these days. So that's good.
Well, yeah, it's fun, and you know. Not having to do it to make my monthly, you know, to make my monthly nut is a luxury, so that I can really do things that, you know, this movie I did in Bulgaria. I think if I got $10,000, you know, it's just, you know, it's for fun and to work on good, exciting things.
That's a nice way to have fun.
Yeah,
especially if you're sharing a scene with Juliette Binoche.
There you go.
Again, we're talking to Captain America here. Why do you think the character of Captain America still resonates with audiences, young and old, nearly 75 years later? We've asked this to Reb Brown as well. I'd like to get your take on it.
Well, you talk about iconic figures. You don't get much more iconic than Captain America. I mean, not a lot of subtle or nuance there. I mean, he's the captain. He represents all that's best about America. So, you know, love America or hate America, you're going to have pretty strong feelings about the character. And that will send the franchise through a whole bunch of decades.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And, you know, the foundation for the current Marvel movies was set in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You were slinging that shield with the best of them on screen. I can't wait for these projects to come out that you mentioned. And, oh, boy, I hope we can see you in a cameo in the next Captain America movie. That would be awesome. Maybe just talking to the Falcon would be kind of slick as well.
There you go. I'm ready.
Hey, Matt Salinger, thank you so much for joining me on Comic Book Central today.
Joe, this was unexpectedly fun. I really enjoyed it.
You know, I think Matt tapped into something there in the interview that really struck a chord with me, and maybe it did with you as well. He mentioned the sense of justice and fairness that characters like Captain America embody. And I really think that's a big reason these characters appeal to all of us as kids and why they still resonate with so many of us all these years later as adults. Think about it. Captain America, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. The styles may change over the years, but those character traits, they're still present in every story told. And that is a truism that applies to the 1990 Captain America film. If you haven't seen it, it's less than $11 for the Blu-ray on Amazon. What a deal. Go get it. As I said, the special effects are very 1990, but the story itself, it's pretty solid. It's very reminiscent of the modern Captain America film, and there's some of the elements there that we see in the X-Men series as well. Check it out. Let me know what you think. joe@comicbookcentral.net is my email address. Or you can check out the Signal Me section on the completely revamped Comic Book Central website, comicbookcentral.net. Again, my thanks to Matt Salinger for spending some time with me in the lair today. Hey, speaking of emails, I think I hear virtual Willie Lumpkin at the Comic Book Central mailbox. And, oh, yep. There it is. We do have a listener email. This week, it is from Jeff Messer. Jeff writes, I've been a fan of the IndieCast for a long time, and I enjoyed your work there. In the past month, I finally checked out Comic Book Central, and I wanted to tell you how great a job you are doing. Loving the show. I'm about to launch some podcasts of my own, and I'm a junkie listening to many podcasts, and yours is among the best. Oh, thanks for writing in, Jeff. Very kind words. Greatly appreciated. I am glad you're enjoying the show, this show and the IndieCast as well. By the way, I'm going to be doing some more recording for the IndieCast here shortly. I promise the return of the Further Adventures of Indiana Jones. So stay tuned. And Jeff, be sure to let us know when your podcast launches. We'd love to hear all about them. Hey folks, thanks again for sharing The Lair on Facebook and Twitter. It's facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork and Twitter at comicbookctrl. You can find hot links to both of those over on the new revamped website. For those who have subscribed in iTunes, there's a link there as well. I thank you. Feel free to post a review of the show. I don't understand all the metrics involved in iTunes, but I know that more reviews means more good stuff for Comic Book Central. And who doesn't want that? That would be awesome. So let me know what you think of the new website. Post a review on the show in iTunes. And hey, keep watching the website for the Comic Book Central shop. CBC merchandise is on the way. Well, that's all the time we have for today. My thanks again to Matt Salinger for spending some time with me in the lair. And hey, speaking of star-spangled spandex-wearing superheroes, next week on Comic Book Central, it's time to slip on my jammies and break out the Cap'n Crunch cereal because it is going to feel like Saturday morning in the 1970s. From the classic animated series Super Friends, the incredible voice of the Amazonian princess Wonder Woman, Shannon Farnan will be here to talk about one of the greatest superhero shows of all time. You don't want to miss it. Talk about retro. This is going to be awesome. Until then, have a super week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
50 years ago, you were Dr. Vasselli's ridiculous idea. You remain a clownish symbol that no one cares about.
I care.